Okay, welcome to LA Lit. LA Lit is a literary podcast show where we interview writers from Los Angeles and or passing through Los Angeles. A very wide view of what Los Angeles is or can be, especially as far as the literary world goes. We are online at la-lit.com. We're currently sitting in beta level, which you can find out about at betalevel.com, and we're sponsored by Superbunker, which is at superbunker.com. A whole lot of websites. But we're happy to have you here, and my name is Matthew Timmons.
I'm Stephanie Ryu, and today our guest is Thérèse Bachan. Thérèse Bachan has two collections of poetry due to be published in 2008. The first is Luce a Cavallo, a 2005 Gertrude Stein Book Award on Green Integer Books, and Daughter of the Ephemeral World on IE Press. Her work has been anthologized in the PIP Anthology of World Poetry, number 5, Intersections, Innovative Poetry in Southern California, and published in many journals, including the Brooklyn Rail, Mirage No. 4 Periodical, Area Sneaks, Minor American, Primary Writing, Beyond Baroque, and Tin Fish. In 2002, she collaborated with Diane Ward and organized a group of LA women poets who meet periodically on a casual basis. Welcome.
Thank you. Sensation is pendant to color. An orange and yellow board hurtles mega through bleached landscape. It is a prickly coronation to the visually harnessed who trek through unknown bustling, unwed quarters, shuttling sands, expressing the discontent of a sake brewer. If you do not perceive my daily ritual, does that make my life extinct? Night has no fears, only strong presences. As light kills dreams, peace becomes the insomniac's delirium. The saucer, a private outrage to the cup. Protest, shifting fibers. At the end of the 20th century, a woman walks backwards down the street. Is this independence, integrity of movement, or unconscious revisit to comfortable pantomimes? Not to ask the pointed question is to depend on evolution of desire. 7 years, cycle of gentle persuasion, waiting precious, dream infant. Quiet dome reasons cerulean loft as my gay flugelhorn whittles fluffy clouds. An attorney and a Dalmatian quicken on silver-tipped and cantering green. Only an arsonist of desire could detach this landscape to meaning. As with all high-altitude investigation, film noir and monotone rendering sacks the plurality of empyrean light. One woman still talking to herself. A rose flames, it is barbaric. I on my rainbowed ottoman detect trees duetting without me. Shiny bald man uses Confederate battle flag as sarong. Her frog prince still swims with tadpoles. He will marry in his phase 3 cathedral. His children will call it home. In dream, he loses his hat. His guardian spirit gives him a magnolia blossom lay. Flower with rhinoceros snout, rusted and moribund, slow to procure this concrete vector. In certain time and place, cars had fins, and a boy might feel chagrin standing bare-chested in storefront eatery. Now he gathers bunchy female admiration. Seabirds possess a similar perceptual locus, secularizing crumbs. Nothing biblical in tacit requests for beauty. Every gospel pleads demolition, a story revision. And this is the last one I'm going to read from this collection. Especially the eye, the whole of it or fractioned here. It's hooray for writers. His fingers fall like rain, tendresse de eau. The myth of pectoral, risk of solace. A scar, a stitched mouth, a reliable grimace, a wedge-comb lens, reminds us of bankruptcy from open mouths. Atlanta's lost utopian retro is again a power to hold square the geometries of this board game. You have been selected to open beyond the whole, and we latitudinals missing the thrill of it.
Thank you. So those are from Daughter of the Ephemeral World, your first book.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you could tell us, just get us going by telling us how that book started. And you did mention earlier, too, about it taking a while to get to admit to yourself that you're a poet or to come to poetry.
Well, it was a project I wanted to do collaborations. And so I decided I had to, like, come up with my own project of collaborations. And I'm sort of a newspaper junkie. I'm a news junkie just to begin with. So I wanted to see what other people did with the news. And I asked a lot of my friends, some of them are sitting here in the the room today, but also just my neighbors and my relatives, to select 7 words from the front page of any newspaper that they read and send me the words. And I would write poems from them, but I was kind of thinking of it not as a found poem, but more of as a using the language of maybe newspaper language or everyday language to write a piece that has to do with everybody's life in some ways, that, you know, grasps on everybody's experience, not just my own experiences.
Is that how it gets this quality of lightness? I mean, this runs through your work altogether, I think, but especially in this piece and also with the title, you know, Ephemeral, and it's very light and delicate. And
I don't know. It's hard to comment on your own work when you're writing it. You don't think, oh, I'm writing lightly, or whatever that means, you know.
That's good, I guess, if you don't do that.
Well, and since you say you're like a news junkie and this drove you to write this book in this way through collaboration, mm-hmm. It's interesting how, like, as Steph says, there's this kind of delicate, you know, ephemeral quality, obviously, to the poetry. But then, while at the same time, you're able to, use lines like "you have been selected" or this, as you said, this kind of everyday language or this more kind of I don't know, like almost official languages or something sometimes bleed in as well?
Well, you know, I had just gotten finished reading my Emily Dickinson right before I started reading this. And Emily Dickinson is probably one of the first poets that, you know, influenced me when I was in high school. My Emily Dickinson is such a radical work, and I was really taken with it. And so I wanted to use, as Emily Dickinson used the vernacular of the sort of evangelistic gospel vernacular in her poetry, I wanted to find a similar vernacular to use in my poetry. So that's why I chose the newspaper, because, there's enough people who go to church, but it's not like the 19th century where, you know, in order to be a decent citizen of the city or the town you lived in, you'd have to be seen in church with, you know, your family. I think nowadays we don't have the same conscriptions on people's behavior. So, but people still even, you know, it's amazing how many people still read the newspaper for all the you know, the people saying, oh, it's a, you know, media that's going out of...
like podcasts and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, people still need content. You know, they still need to have, like, actual journalists who go out and have sort of credentials and ethics and go out and find the story. And they need content on the internet, too. That's they don't generally get it from newspapers. So... But, you know, most, even my daughters read newspapers, and I don't really think that of them as being, you know, that, you know, ephemeral in some ways, you know, so, but, yeah.
So it sounds like you're a news junkie, not just so much to stay informed, although I'm sure that's part of it, but also because of, there's just so much language in the paper.
I do like everyday language, and I don't know, I grew up watching Huntley and Brinkley and, you know, Bill, you know, all these big, the big guys. I don't know why I was like, I think it's because I had a very protected childhood, and it seemed like the news was a way out of like learning things outside of your realm. I was really addicted to Life magazine, anything that like spoke to something outside of my realm, because I didn't go a lot of places when I was a child. So that was the way I went places, was really by, you know, reading the newspaper and reading magazines and looking at TV, the news and stuff. And yeah. And my grandmother actually was big in listening to like talk radio in like the 60s and 70s. She also listened to like a lot of radio, and I mean, it kind of runs in my family. I think we all have this sort of tendency.
Yeah, and another thing I found interesting, and I think it comes out more as we'll go move on into other books of yours, but I think is in this book as well, in this manuscript, that kind of cuts across this more daily language, or makes that daily language stand out, is this, there are kind of moments of kind of surrealistic imagery, kind of surrealistic narrative-y. Like there's a part that you're talking about, the guy who kisses the frog prince and is getting married in his phase three cathedral, and these kind of like weird, you know, very light, and but at the same time like this kind of other, it's, you know, I don't know if they were really writing about that in the news, but you know what I mean? It's like these other kind of more surrealish kind of imagery and situations, and then there's and I think some of that is also coming from like there's mentions of film noir. There's these kind of aspects of film, which I guess is more in your other work, but I feel like there's allusions to it already in here.
So yeah, I guess maybe in some ways I react to the newspaper not just as a verbal presence, but as a visual presence. In a funny way, I like the way that I like it that it's typeset. It's the same thing that, you know, I was talking earlier about chapbooks. I really like the visual quality of a chapbook as opposed to a book. It has an integrity that you never quite get with a book in a certain way. It's a different integrity, yeah. but it's a visually unique integrity. And the newspaper has that quality also. Yeah. And there's nothing worse than yesterday's news. You know, once you've read it and it's, you know, the newspaper the next day is old. I mean, there's some articles you can read again, but it doesn't have that same, like, I can hardly wait to open it up. I always feel that way about a newspaper.
Yeah.
I want to see what's happened.
But in the case of writing these poems, you were getting words from people. It was obvious, and then you were working on the poems, so by the time you got the words from people, the time you were working on the poems, like, what they were pulling from was, like, yesterday's news, right?
Yeah, and I wasn't really reacting to like whatever they. I mean, there are certain poems, like the poem about the sake brewer is actually a. There was an article about sake brewers in Japan, and I did sort of include that. And there's another one where I was telling you where I included the photo in the poem, but most of them have nothing to do with whatever, because people would take words from several different articles. Also, I didn't feel any obligation to write anything about what was happening.
But. Well, I have a question, and of course, I'm like, should I ask this? I don't know. But it's a concern of mine. Why the vernacular as opposed to the lofty? Or maybe not as opposed to, but maybe we could talk about.
What would the lofty be?
I don't know, not the vernacular, the lofty. I don't know what it would be. You know, the heightened language that people associate with poetry.
So, give me an example.
Well, how can I give you an example without going through some big, long thing? Shakespeare. I mean, I guess to us it sounds lofty now. Maybe back then it was like, whatever, just talking street talk or whatever. But, I mean, I think those distinctions weren't present, but I don't know, just question. Like what, you bring up the vernacular, the language of the common people.
Well, I could have been using the vernacular from church, maybe then it would have been more lofty. And I do have that experience, but I wanted to use a vernacular which I'm participating in now. Uh-huh. I'm not participating in the, I mean, I think that's what gives any work its intensity, is that you're actually using these words every day. I mean, you're having a relationship with them, which is not just artistic, they have a utilitarian value. So if Emily Dickinson's using gospel, you know, words from the gospel or from a sermon that her pasture is given, she's still using things that are concerning her every day. And that was more my model than something that I just had an abstract intellectual, you know, relationship to.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so it's interesting because you, I mean, this is for you, as you said, when you first, we first started talking about this, you said, this is a really old book to me.
It is old, yeah.
So, like, can you talk about, I mean, you said you were, like, when you wrote it, and when you wrote it, like, what was the, like, because I think you said it was 99 to 2001, right?
I finished it. The last poem, I got the words right before 9/11, and I actually wrote the poem right after 9/11. So in some ways that was really fortuitous, because then the newspaper became much different sort of beast after that, you know. And I was happy I had this little project beforehand. I wanted to write for people, my friends, I wanted them to read the poems, and I guess it was just a little sneaky and obvious way to get them to participate and read the poems. I don't think they were gonna read them if I had just written things they didn't. I have a lot of friends that are not academics, you know. So I was concerned. I didn't want to just write poems for academic people. I've never really wanted to do that, particularly, and so I guess it was just my kind of obviously clunky way of coming around to that.
Like including your friends the outset, so they'll.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool. And then can you, maybe a further question would be, what can you say about how you wrote, I mean, that, you know, you wrote this, I mean, for me, I'm thinking about how I wrote, like, several years ago, and then how you come to, like, understand some of the techniques you were using then even better. Can you talk about some of the things that you were doing back then that you're still doing?
Well, Diane Ward suggested I use a palette of words. So that was the seven words thing. But then it just becomes a kind of a meditation on those words. And it really is, I don't want to say soothing, but there's some inner kind of transformation that goes on, unconscious transformation. And I guess what would happen normally would be that I tend to write when I'm not sitting at a desk, so I'm thinking about it all the time, and especially in the morning, I'll take my dog on a walk, and it's about an hour, and I'm thinking about it all the way when I'm walking, and then I'll think about it all morning, and then sometime in the afternoon, I'll sit down for about a half hour and work it out. Mm-hmm. And then later that evening, I would read them all aloud to myself. It was very important that they sounded right. Not just that they came together in, you know, certain other ways, but I like the aspect of sounding right to me. They have to sound right to me.
Yeah.
Well, should we hear some more work?
Yeah.
Is it a good time then?
Sure.
Maybe we could ask this. Can anybody have any questions about that section? Do we? Or you don't have questions? Okay. So these poems are from the second book, Luce a Cavallo. Ephemeral Verite from Belle de Jour. A secret love can be the perfect coldness, upsetting any anniversary by forgetting to forgive. A magician cannot understand the softness of snow or the hypnotist's beautiful but unfortunate obsession with hunting. Better to be underground in the cheerful and shy profession of smoke and perfume, awaiting fresh expenses in the matter of hello. Close the curtain. Money is the man's job, as is savoring ham and sausages, a good pair of legs. I like to have a good time beyond champagne and pouting. My temperature rumors the dark and classy, the fair game upstairs. Death contrives homework that grieves lilies, that accepts the closed door of a letter, the scratching expiation of friendship. My unborn son is blonde. He was struck by jasmine, is clueless to my address, his identity. Code prefix from Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. An occurrence depicted from a high level cannot be learned from the dead. Ultimately, the confirmation of a bomb is a moment of beeping from Arctic peaks. I trust no one because the purity of transmission cannot be verified 24 hours a day. R is for Romeo. Don't penetrate the superiority of my baby. Orders are reserved for stooges and degenerates of the plane, personally. The anonymous friendly call is part of the theory of fatigue. Flying glass may be a deterrent, but the essence of guessing is recalling the bold of curiosity. My override is deeper than the radioactivity of swines. Acknowledge the magnanimous and recall the sleigh bells of unclaimed innocence. Be happy from Faces. And there's a little quote from Alice Notley's Disobedience. Smart things do look better broken. Ruined art looks better, ruined ideas. The part you loved most gone, the gloss and color, illusion of dominance. Inside the yawn of good mornings, coffee becomes the analyst's drink, a correspondence between commerce and guilt. Be happy. The force is with you, Freudian fairies. Who cares if the Lone Ranger rid his bullet in your pristine, perfect boudoir? Pocket the charge of smiles behind a martyred kiss. Even in a dirty movie, a cigarette has a point of view. Virility is the clock in all coffins, the dignified promo of divorced salesmen who plucked their cleaned-up babes straight from the lungs of aluminum department stores and pretend to raise the ridiculous into a disposition of friendship. All socks drown on these tennis courts. Express yourself. It's fun to party with young boys and pretend to skate away on Carry That Tune. Please stay awake. Nobody has time to be vulnerable to your silly problems, you mechanical little puss. You don't even love me, even though I saved your life. A Truthful Thought from Juliet of the Spirits. Shall light make a blonde wig quick? A napkin can excite a bathroom ghost. This Aquarian takes pleasures in the secret recipes of her guests, while the manifestations of a pendulum purify the hero of his seasonal illusions. Love is a religion for the smoking and sincere, an uprooted experiment that the oracle refined while washing fruit, a dress rehearsal for a pie. The unconfessed maintain their equilibrium in corolla of daylight, flirting shamelessly with the horizontal variations of a TV. Transformation is always a delicate harmony for a blush or a thief, but a candle gambles on the dizzy anxiety of first love. He says, to love someone, you must know everything. But isn't this just a floral tribute for a spontaneous wife? Go from the King of Marvin Gardens for Andrew Maxwell. Grandfather promised me a fish. He was an enthusiast about bones. Just as my throat diminishes air, a kingdom circulates in my ass. I'm host to moving stories. I've worked out a shore where a priest and a brother kibitz at sundown. Thanks to a gentleman whose accommodations include both candles and electricity, I piss off the jury and still have a beautiful time with politicians. Gambling in villas is a half-cocked exercise. I must remain serene in my bunk. Let the police be grim. It's rusty out there. But a bubble bath heals a grudge. Such circumstances register a hard-on. Literature is a hustle for every artist. Beyond the goodwill, the facelifting images, ruminations lead to acres of receipts. It feels like walking on blue custard with the fairest dolphins under the sun. My gratitude is an island full of depression and suspicion. No matter how deep the mistrust, vanity is such furry finery. A disappointed sleepwalker circumunicates his cabin, smarter than the philosopher whose ventures a fire of trivial conversation. I've made my own love nest, harmless, full of water pistols, disappearing into yonder territories. And I think the last one I'm going to read from this is The Black Hair from Qui-Gon, the first little movie in Qui-Gon called The Black Hair. A hold, a river, a graph, black glass, ideogram of connubial presence, prescience. Poverty makes for elegant advancement. It constructs before action, as though distant service may be construed to mean, bury the weaver here. Yes, it's true, there's thoughtfulness and family value. Memories are unfair, always gentle and patient in return to regret, in persisting first. See, you cannot find a little cemetery there. The cruel and dissatisfied merely forget, savoring a dream as if it were dawn forever.
So shall we take a short break and then we'll be back?
In the break time?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.